This is the second lecture on Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin.
I was forewarned by my wife tonight not to give a long lecture. And so without further ado, I'm going to sit down too. In the middle of the 18th century, to be exact, in 1749, the rabbi of the small Lithuanian town of Volozhin was a man called Rabbaya Ginsburg, Rabbaya HaKohen Ginsburg, whom people of Torah know better as the great Shagas Aryeh, one of the greatest luminaries of the Torah world. He was the rabbi of Volozhin, and he would make it a practice every now and then to visit at the home of the wealthy Reb Yitzchak in town. The reason for his visit was not social. He was not the type who would socialize most of his life. The reason was that he didn't have a shas. He didn't have a set of the Talmud. Very few people did in that particular age. But Reb Yitzchak was a wealthy man, and he had married a wealthy woman. And as part of her dowry, of her nadan, she brought with her a shas, the only one in all of Volozhin. And so whenever the rabbi would have to look up something, he would make his way to the home of Reb Yitzchak and spend a good part of the night there. But this particular time that he spent at the home of Reb Yitzchak and Rivka, which was the first night of Shavuos, 1749, was rather inappropriate because the good lady was about to deliver her first baby. And she was very anxious for the rabbi to go home. It's generally difficult to get an unwanted guest to go home, and with a rabbi, sometimes it's more difficult. And it was becoming terribly troubling to her. So she pleaded with her husband, do something. And he couldn't. And finally, he decided to summon up enough guts and chutzpah, and he came to the Shagas Aryeh, and he said to him, Rebbe, do me a favor and go home. My wife is simply too embarrassed to cry out, and she has to. And the Shagas Aryeh looked at him, distracted for a moment, and said, don't worry, it'll be a good child, and continued to study. The next morning, Reb Chaim Volozhin was born. And it was a good child. It was a man who had achieved a tremendous reputation in history, both he and his younger brother, Reb Zalman Volozhin. The Jewish world then was characterized by instability and uncertainty. 1749 was just about 100 years after the terrible Khmelnytsky massacres and pogroms. The very day that Reb Chaim was born was the day that the sainted Graf Potocki, the great Ger, the great noble Polish nobleman who had converted to Judaism, was martyred by the Catholic Church. It was about 80 years after the great Sabbatian heresy, the Shabbat Tzvi heresy, which still had reverberations only 2 years before the birth of Reb Chaim, in the great controversy between Reb Yaakov Emden and Reb Yonis in Prague, Reb Yonis in Eibeschutz. It was about 14 years after the Baal Shem Tov had revealed his new way, the way of Hasidism, and had swept up the entire Jewish world of Eastern Europe, even as there were some hints of a quasi-Hasidic movement beginning, but never coming to anything, in Germany with Reb Noson Adler. It was a time that the Jewish world was rent apart by tremendous polemics between Hasidim and their opponents, the Misnagdim. The family, as I mentioned, was fairly well-to-do, of course, by the standards of Lithuania in the middle of the 18th century. The young Chaim was a student of great teachers, Reb Rafael Hamburger, a great Gaon, a great scholar, and a very moderate man, and the Shagas Aryeh. One of his colleagues, the great Reb Baruch of Shklov, tells us that when Reb Chaim was 22 years old, he had already gone through and remembered all of the Talmud and its commentaries. Of course, if you compare this to what we heard 2 weeks ago, it's nothing terribly great. But when you consider most other mortals, It is a great achievement. He took his first position. It was after 22 that he first became a student of the Vilna Gaon. He took his first position, his first rabbinic position, in a town called Vilkomir. He accepted no salary. I must have a masochistic strain in me. Every week I tell you stories I really shouldn't. He accepted no salary and instead had a sideline in the woolen business. But apparently, no matter what a rabbi does in certain communities, it's not good. The woolen merchants were very upset by this fact. And because they were very upset, legend has it, and after being in the rabbinate 15 or 16 years, I don't think it's a legend, they decided to trip him up and embarrass him. And so they came to him one Shabbos morning and they said aloud for everyone to hear, "Rabbi, do you say Ovar Rachamim today?" What difference does it make? You do say or don't say, it's not that important. He said, "Look it up in the Luach, in the manual for such things. Why do you ask me such shilas?" So immediately they began to spread a rumor, what kind of rabbi is this if he doesn't know if you say Ovar Rachamim today? Years later, Reb Chaim was to tell all his students preparing for the rabbinate, the most important thing is to buy a luach and always be prepared with Ovar Rachamim. Nevertheless, he was sufficiently disconcerted by this traumatic event to leave Vilkomir after a stay of 1 year, and he left for Volozhin, which in a sense was going from the frying pan into the fire. Is Mr. Walper here? Mr. Walper, on behalf of all your landslide in Volozhin, please forgive me for what I'm going to say. But Volozhin did not have a good reputation for having fine balabatim. It's only when they came to America that they became so wonderful. Nevertheless, perhaps because of the challenge, Reb Chaim developed a marvelous reputation. He was a paternal type. And in many small ways, he began to reveal that brilliance that was so characteristic of the Gaon. Let me give you a very, very small incident that is told of Reb Chaim during his early years of the rabbinate in Volozhin. As the rabbi, he of course was in charge of many of the charitable enterprises. And one man had applied for a charity from the community when Reb Chaim felt he didn't deserve it. There were many far poorer people who deserved it. And he told them, "I happen to know that you possess at least 200 gilden, $200, and according to the Mishnah, anyone who owns $200 is not that poor that he should be permitted to take from charity and deprive others who are less affluent than he. Since you have 200 gilden, you can't get the tzedakah. I disqualify you." And the man was furious. He says, "You rabbis and your mishnas and your shulchan aruchs, but where in the Torah do you have that a man can't take tzedakah unless he has $200? He said, "Very simple." He said, "Take the word tzedakah itself and count it. Tzadik is 90, dalad is 4, kuf is 100, hey is 5. Together, 199. So the word tzedakah itself shows you that only unto $199 may you take from others. Otherwise, you're not permitted to take tzedakah." He was a man of great insight into personality. As a matter of fact, when the Gaon died in 1797, Lithuanian Jewry felt as if it had undergone a tremendous traumatic experience that Reb Chaim personally keeps on writing, even when he was much older, of the time of the death of the Gaon, as if he had lost the greatest prop in his life. And it was shortly after the death of the Gaon that the whole Lithuanian community rallied about Reb Chaim, and interestingly, only because of one rather simple incident. A man appeared in Vilna and then in Volozhin, a man who was rather strange and fantastic in his appearance, came in white clothing, a Sephardi, who didn't talk much, but he just came to the synagogue and prayed with tremendous fervor and cried bitter tears, made a great impression, came to the rabbis of the community and would discuss the situation of the Jews, never talked in Torah with them, which was strange because a rabbi should talk in Torah. And the community as such began to weave a whole web of myths and legends about him. He came from the other side of the Sambatyon, and he's going to bring the Mashiach. And others said, "He is the Mashiach." And in a community of this sort, by word of mouth, things began to build up. And people began to trust him, and he came to one rabbi, to another balabas, and asked questions, how is the community, what is going on? As soon as Reb Chaim heard about this in Volozhin, what is occurring in Vilna, he said, immediately, inform all businessmen in Vilna to get rid of their contraband goods. The Jews of Vilna, in order to survive, had to participate in several illegal undertakings. Of course, here in America, we can be critical of it, but there it was a matter of survival under a Malchus HaRashah. And they had goods which the government forbade them. And so he said, let everyone immediately get rid of it. They did, not knowing why Reb Chaim had instructed them to do so, but they were afraid. They did it. 2 weeks later, this strange, mysterious guest came with a battalion of police to the homes and the businesses of all the people, all the Balabatim of Vilna. He was a government spy. And Reb Chaim, by sheer psychological insight, was able to detect him. He was called the Krima. He came from the Crimea. And since then, the story of the Der Krima was one of the great incidents that led to the public acceptance of Reb Chaim, as he ultimately became the outstanding leader of Lithuanian and Russian Jewry. And people said of him, Chacham Odif Menovi. A wise man, a Chacham, is even better than a prophet. His primary achievement was the building of the Volozhiny Yeshiva, which didn't have a name in his lifetime. After his death, it received the name Eitz Chaim, in honor of him whose name was Chaim. It began with 10 students who met at his home, and he supported them out of his own pocket. After a while, the support became difficult. The story has it that his wife sold her jewelry in order to be able to contribute to the support of these students. And then, about the year 1801, 1802, 1803, Reb Chaim sent an open letter to all of Lithuanian Jewry, pleading with them to open a yeshiva, which was something that they didn't understand. He said, no longer 10 or 20 students with a rabbi in a community, but an institution, and I will be the first to contribute to it. Thus was begun the Yeshiva of Volozhin, about which we will have more to say in a short while. Let me come back to the Gaon. Reb Chaim's relationship with the Gaon was unusual. He was acknowledged by everyone, especially the children of the Gaon himself, as the leading disciple of the Vilna Gaon. His discipleship was not expressed in the usual manner, whereby a student sits at the feet of the teacher and studies a whole year for several years, but rather, throughout his life, Reb Chaim would come to Vilna two or three times a year, spend two or three months, 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, present to the Gaon all the questions he had, receive his answers, and leave. In this manner, the Gaon, who was a rather remote personality, established his closest relationship with Reb Chaim Volozhin. His reverence for the Gaon was absolutely beyond belief. Let me read to you a report by Reb Yitzchak, the son of Reb Chaim Volozhin, who told this to the Netziv, who told this to others, and it came down finally in written form. Thus speaks Reb Yitzchak Volozhin. Once he said, Father, meaning Reb Chaim, Father prepared to travel to the Gaon. I said to Father, and Reb Yitzchak is now a youngster, I too want to journey to the rabbi. Father was overwhelmed and said to me, trembling, you too want to travel to the rabbi? I too became frightened, but nevertheless I persisted and stated, yes, I wish to do so. Father hesitated, but he finally agreed and we went off. As we were on our way, I noticed Father's face, and behold, he had turned pale because of fear and trembling. As the wagon drew closer to Vilna, Father's face became even more pale. By the time we came to Vilna, it was difficult to recognize him. Again he turned to me and inquired, trembling, you too want to go into the rabbi? I gathered myself together and said, yes. As we were standing at the door of the chamber of the Gaon, his knees actually quaked out of awe for his teacher. And for the last time, he said to me, now you're sure you too want to go into the rabbi? Thus did we enter the chamber of the Gaon of Vilna. If you recall from 2 weeks ago, the description Rav Chaim gives of the Gaon's mystic graces, his charisma, his superhuman greatness, you can understand why Rav Chaim took this attitude of awe towards his Rebbe. It is true that the brilliance, the sheer intelligence of the Gaon overshadowed Rav Chaim. But nevertheless, it is equally true that if not for Rav Chaim, the Gaon might have been a closed book. In 1921, at the occasion of the 100th Yahrzeit of Rav Chaim, the late and sainted Rav Kook delivered a drasha in honor of the Yahrzeit, in which he said that Rav Chaim was Megala the Gaon. He revealed the Gaon. The Gaon would have remained a shut book, concealed, unknown to the world, except for fame, but unknown in his principles, if not for the fact that Rav Chaim spelled out exactly what the Gaon meant. It is therefore not true, as Louis Ginsberg had it, that the Gaon was the last great theologian of classic rabbinic Judaism. I believe that if you look through the Gaon's writings, it's very difficult to find any kind of consistent approach to Judaism. You find greatness, tremendous greatness, but a consistent system you find only in the writings of Rav Chaim, who is the most radical, the most comprehensive expositor of halachic or rabbinic Judaism. He shared many characteristics, personal ones, with the object of his admiration, the Gaon. Both of them had an ascetic bent. There's only one drasha that we have of Rav Chaim, and the whole drasha turns about his complaint that people say, as der Welt is euch a Welt. There's a Yiddish expression, this world is also a world. Rav Chaim was unhappy with this expression because it revealed too much infatuation with the benefits of this world. More important, he shared with the Gaon a fantastic dedication to truth, a refusal to bow to authority and abandon your own thinking and your own mind. He thanks God in a letter that he writes, not in a letter, in a response from a tshuva. I thank God, he says, that men's opinions are not identical, that ilu v'ilu divrei Elokim chayim, both these and these are the words of the living God, provided that he direct our hearts to render a decision that accords with the truth of the Torah. And he, blessed he, meaning God, for the sake of his seal of emes, of truth, may he open our eyes to find the way of truth in the Torah, which is called truth. Rav Chaim, therefore, had only one principle, emes, and everything else must be shoved aside in favor of emes. Therefore, Rav Chaim, though he lived in the 18th century and beginning of the 19th, was a man who would act on his own psak halacha, on his own decision, as if his own decision were given by the Rishonim of the Middle Ages. As long as he figured out his approach, he had confidence and he paskened the shayla on that basis. This, incidentally, terribly aggravated and upset the other East European Gedolim who worked mostly on hierarchical authority. There's a Shulchan Aruch, and there's a Ramah, and there's a Shach, and a Taz. I can have an opinion, but I can't paskin that way. Rav Chaim said, no, them I consult, but I decide. And if my mind tells me that this is the decision, then this is what I am going to do. He taught, it is forbidden for a student to accept his teacher's words if he finds them deficient, for the truth is sometimes with the student. And when in the interest of objective truth we disagree with a teacher or with a famous authority of ages gone by, we must disagree. He calls this a milchames mitzvah, a holy war, and we must fight the war without giving quarter to any authority. If we are convinced that we are right, of course, it doesn't mean anyone can come and utter an opinion. There's a difference, as Plato put it, between opinions and ideas. It means it has to be a studied, considered, and well-supported idea. One, he says, one ought not have any personal regard for any man in learning, no submission to authority, only the love of truth, on condition, of course, that we sit in the dust of their feet with humility and modesty. So this is his intellectual integrity. This is his respect for truth as he saw it. And this characterizes his whole methodology, his whole character, his whole religious thought, and what he brought into Valajan. Interestingly, there's another minor characteristic he shared with Thoreau, and if you still remember, and that is he had a distrust for medicine and doctors. He learned it from his Rebbe. He didn't like doctors and he didn't like medicines. He's told that once when he was sick, his family prevailed upon him to avail himself of the services of a local doctor, an old Christian doctor, an elderly man, whom they called in to examine him, and after the examination, the doctor prescribed a whole list of drugs. And Reb Chaim smiled and said, "You know, doctor, I really don't believe in these things." So the doctor was offended. He said, "You don't believe in them? I want you to know that medicines are effective only if you believe in them as you believe in Jesus." And Reb Chaim said, "That's the point, doctor. That's the point." His character, in contrast to the Gaon, was not remote but very intimate. He was a very warm human being from everything we hear about him. Extremely kind. His biographer, and we have only one brief biography of this man, but he should have a whole volume, says of him that he was a man with a golden heart. His son, Reb Yitzchak, says that his father would always tell him that the purpose for which we were brought into the world is lahoil la'achrinei, to help and do good to others. He has a letter to his grandson in which he says the follows, and it's very illuminating of his character. "Never allow any enmity, any hatred towards another person to enter your heart, and certainly never answer another person with impudence or impatience. For by means of tolerance, a man can attain far more than by all the harshness in the world. In general, make yourself acceptable to people insofar as you can. Yet, do not engage excessively in idle conversation with any individual. Always be the first to extend greetings to someone else and respond calmly. Never be haughty towards another man in any matter, for when a man's heart grows proud, he is considered an abomination." Well, this is the character of the man. Let's now discuss his thinking and his activities in three areas: educational philosophy and the yeshiva, his theology, if we may use the term, and his attitudes to Hasidism, and finally, his conception of Torah. Lithuania was not only poor, but an ignorant country. The Gaon's emergence raised the status of scholarship. People became conscious of the fact that a Talmud Chacham is a great man. They worshipped the Talmud Chacham, but they didn't begin to study. It did not affect their own learning. This remained for Reb Chaim to do. He founded the yeshiva, as I said before, about 1802. At that time, the whole institution was regarded as a curiosity, as something very quaint. Many years later, Reb Yosef of Krinki, who in his younger days was one of the first students of Reb Chaim in the yeshiva, writes in his old age, and what he's going to say now is mostly to be trusted, although he's writing the letter as part of a fundraising effort, and such things are always to be taken with a grain of salt. Again, I shouldn't say that. He says as follows: "Before the house of the Lord," by which he means what? The yeshiva. "Before the house of the Lord was established by the angel of the Lord, our holy rabbi," meaning Reb Chaim, "the world was desolate, void and formless. Even the name yeshiva was as yet unknown in the world of Lita, of Lithuania, what it is all about and what one does there. The idea of the public study of Torah was likewise unknown. For the world was desolate of Torah, even the books of the Talmud were completely unavailable except to the chosen few, the famous rich. Even in the synagogues, the Bote Medrash, of the large towns, a complete set of the Talmud could not be found, for there was no need of it, since hardly anyone engaged in the study of Torah. During the first year that the house of the Lord was founded in Volozhin, I remember many merchants who went out of their way in order to pass by Volozhin to see what a yeshiva is all about and what one does there. And when they came and they saw that several tens of great Torah scholars, not little boys, but adults, were sitting and studying all night with remarkable assiduousness and effort, they wondered and marveled at this very much. The final achievement of the yeshiva was historic. For one century, it was the greatest yeshiva in the entire world. The yeshiva of Volozhin spawned dozens of other yeshivas that dominated the 18th and 19th, rather the 19th and the 20th centuries. He began the yeshiva with a critique against the study of Torah in his age. The custom was that a rabbi in the town would gather a few bocherim, a few young men, have them in his home, study with them. Then when they would go out to work, we'd get another few people. This was the extent of the study of Torah. And people, rabbis, were reluctant to build one yeshiva because each one would lose his own little domain. It was a kind of an educational analog of shtiblach. In shuls, everyone has a little shtibl. Who wants to go to a big shul? I don't become a gabbai if I go to a big shul. The same thing was true with Talmud Torah. Every rabbi had his little group and was reluctant to let anyone else participate. Reb Chaim considered this a wrong kind of private enterprise, an excessive academic individualism, and protested it. The yeshiva of Volozhin was first and foremost a formal school. It was not just a local school. It was not meant only for Volozhin. It drew and attracted students from all over Europe, and even from outside of Europe, later from America, but in the beginning also from the Holy Land. It was the first such school in 150 years. In size, too, it was important. In the days of Reb Chaim, it reached from 10 to 50 and then to 100 students. Under the stewardship of his son Reb Yitzchak, 200. When the great Netziv, the Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, was for 40 years the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin, he officially had 250 students, unofficially 400. Why the discrepancy? Because the Russians, who are always dear friends of ours, would not permit more than 250 students, so he registered 250 students, but meanwhile he had 400. Other schools do it the other way around, but he had 250 officially, actually many, many more. Reb Chaim, in his own self-image, considered himself primarily an educator. He would frequently sign his letters, at the end of the letter, he always would write, incidentally, Nefesh HaChaim. I say goodbye to you with a Nefesh HaChaim, the soul of Chaim. Nefesh HaChaim means the living soul, and his name was Chaim. He signed Nefesh HaChaim. Nefesh HaChaim HaMalamed BeVolozhin, the Malamed of Volozhin. In other words, when Reb Chaim became a Malamed, so to be a Malamed was no longer a thing that you looked down upon. He was the great Malamed. His form of education was complete. He insisted upon creating an atmosphere, not just teaching Gemara and Tosfos, not just Shulchan Aruch, but he wanted a school because he wanted to create a personality of Torah, not just a mind that was stuffed with Torah unrelated to the rest of him. Therefore, although we had no formal study of ethics, Reb Chaim was very much against Musar study. He distrusted the study of ethics as a separate course. He didn't have any confidence in its ultimate value, and the great battle took place a generation and two later, whether the Lithuanian yeshivas should study Musar or not, and each side claimed that Reb Chaim would have been for him. At any rate, in his school, they did not study Musa. But the total effect was that the personality that was produced was one of Midos Tovos. You can understand that this is a very important element in any school, especially a school of Torah. I had dinner yesterday with a friend of mine from Israel, Pinchas Peli, who told me a marvelous story. He said that in the Gola, some country of the diaspora, a man wanted to teach his children Hebrew. So he engaged the teacher, and for 2 years he was hacking in them, Hebrew, Hebrew, Hebrew. At the end of 2 years, someone asked him, do they know anything? He said, they know 3 words, no more. They can say Bevakasha, Toda, and Slicha. More than that, they don't know. So the man said to him, if that's all they learned in 2 years, send them to a school in Israel, and then they'll learn. So he decided to do it. And he sent them to a school in Israel, and 2 years later, this other man met the father. He said, well, do they know any Hebrew now? He said, now they know everything, except for 3 words. So to learn these 3 words and to learn Midas Tovos should be part of not the curriculum, but the goal of every school. Reb Chaim created a revolution in educational philosophy, which until then, with the exception of the Maharal Prague, much earlier and in a different context, had not been much studied or thought through by Gedolei Yisrael. Number one, in Talmud study, he adopted the methodology of the Vilna Gaon. You recall 2 weeks ago we spoke of the two methods, internal and external criticism, of the Gaon. Reb Chaim took the method of internal criticism. No fantastic intellectual gymnastics, but coming straight through to a problem. What he calls Sivara Yeshara, straight thinking, or Iyun Yeshar, straight investigation. Never mind the acrobatics of the mind, cut through to a problem analytically and categorically. He aimed, furthermore, in his discussions of the Talmud, not merely at understanding the text, but also at deriving a psak. Therefore, what is the conclusion? He always was interested in the conclusion in order to know practice. He would strive, as we pointed out, only for emes, for truth. And so much was he possessed by this quest for truth that it developed almost into what we might call intellectual masochism. By this I mean that if Reb Chaim would come upon a chiddush, a tremendous idea, a fantastic, novel, original idea, which would solve a dozen problems in one stroke, and everyone would be very excited about it, then Reb Chaim would sit back and say, you know, it's possible the whole thing is not really true. He would always attempt to undermine his chiddush because he wanted to make sure that he wasn't just posturing. Sometimes a very sharp mind can devise all kinds of ideas which overwhelm you with its virtuosity. But it's not true. Marvelous idea, but they're not true. He would always suspect himself of being too smart. And therefore, if he would express a chiddush, he would actually worry himself into destroying it. And only if he couldn't undermine it was he willing to accept it as something valid and something true. His second principle in his educational philosophy was his opposition to what is known in English as autodidactism, which is a big word for a small idea, namely to be self-taught. He did not believe in a man teaching himself. His educational psychology was such that he said it is preferable for the learning mind to hear rather than to see. A man can read and learn a great deal, but when he hears it and he discusses it, then all false leads are cut off, and the hearing impresses itself on the mind better than seeing. You know, it is true that some mentalities, for reasons that are beyond most of us today, can get the seeing better than the hearing. But the hearing is an older method, and apparently it still remains a better method for most people. One who discusses it to a great extent in contemporary times, incidentally, is Marshall McLuhan. He also developed, I'm not making any immediate comparisons, but the problem is a real problem. He also developed as a result what is known in yeshivas to this day as the chavrusa system. Namely, that if I sit in the besmeresh, I don't study by myself. Gemara, Torah, I study with a partner, a chava. The two of us study together. One says and the other listens. Then I say and he listens. As a result, both of us grow together. And from experience, I can tell you this. When I study myself, I go off on all kinds of byways, and it'll take me 2 months to come back to the right way. When I study with someone else, he immediately catches my error, and I catch his errors, and both of us proceed. Of course, it's easier to talk about other things, too. But on the other hand, it's easier to daydream by yourself. And the Chavrusa system is a marvelous system. I can say for myself that I've learned much more in the Chavrusa system than I have by myself. Reb Chaim once said this, according to Pirkei Avos, the Mishnah tells us, Shnayim sheyoshvim, v'ein b'neihem divrei Torah, hareza moshev leitzim. Two people who sit, and there are no words of Torah between them, this is a moshev leitzim, the seat of scoffers. Why? He said, if two students sit on the besmedrash, and each one studies by himself, v'ein b'neihem divrei Torah, the words of Torah do not go back and forth between the two of them. They don't study with each other. Then this is a Moshe of Leitzim. It's a seat of scoffers because each one scoffs at the other. Look at him. He's also a Lamban. He also thinks he knows what he's studying. Everyone is too proud and arrogant to condescend to ask the other man. As a result, neither of them knows enough. All they have acquired is the ability to be supercilious and haughty. He believed, third, in developing a very warm teacher-student relationship. He believed that the teacher must be humble, not that he has to be a softie, but that in the clash, and we're not speaking now of teachers of little children, but teachers on a higher level, that in the clash between teacher and student, the teacher must not imagine that his superior position academically somehow endows him with superior wisdom. It is not so. He maintains that lifa'amim ha'emesim ha'talmud mipnei she'etz katan madlik etz gadol. Sometimes the student is right, just as a large stick cannot catch fire until you take a small stick and take the flame with the small stick and kindle the larger one. Sometimes the student is the one who inspires the teacher, and without the teacher could never learn. Hence, you find in the prime a tremendous amount of intellectual integrity, and it goes through the family. I know that, personally, I think the most impressive thing in my life in yeshiva was one shiur that I had with Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, my teacher, who, as you know, is a great-great-grandson of Reb Chaim Volozhiner. He had been developing a theory for about 6 or 7 weeks. We had 2 shiurim a week. 6 or 7 weeks, it was a Masechta Shabbos, a whole theory. And it was coming to the climax, and everything was falling into place beautifully in the intellectual architectonics of his theory. And one friend of mine, who now is a physicist in Washington, raised his hand and said, the whole thing doesn't work. Rabbi Soloveitchik in those days was even more excitable than he is today. He said, what are you talking about? And he said, the Chedushei Haran says such and such. He says, what does he say? He said, the Chedushei Haran, and he quoted the Chedushei Haran to the best of his memory. Rabbi Soloveitchik stepped back and said, Imkain, he said, forget everything I told you the last 6 weeks. Now, any other Rosh Yeshiva, any other professor, would have immediately downed a student to try to work his way out one way or another. But he didn't. In fact, I remember what he did. He took out of his pocket, we never knew that he had notes. We thought the whole thing is, you know, just spawned out of his mind as he goes on. He put his hand into his breast pocket, took out his notes, and tore page after page. It tore my heart. It tore my heart even more because the next Tuesday he came back with a Chedushei Haran. He showed it to Chaim, this friend of mine. He said, you didn't know what you're talking about. So he had to rewrite the whole thing all over again. But the fact that he was ready to destroy it showed that this is La'amita Shel Torah. This is integrity. The fact that he's a student doesn't mean that I know more than he does. And this really is a characteristic of Reb Chaim of Volozhiner. He set great standards for the yeshiva. No one was able to enter unless he passed a very difficult examination. He did not have an open admissions policy. He did not want the yeshiva to become a refuge for the otherwise unemployable and the embittered. His greatest principle in studying, in his educational philosophy, was the principle of Amal HaTorah, Amal, which means work. His emphasis was not on achievement, not on marks. His emphasis was on effort. His whole philosophy, and we'll see later why, was geared to the amount of work that you put in. And he made it the principle that when it comes to Torah, ma'aseh halimud hu ha'ikar, lo ha'yediyah shehu ha'tafel. The act of studying is fundamental. The acquisition of knowledge is secondary. So that if you have one student who is less agile mentally, but he studies a great deal, he's a masmid. He is far greater, Jewishly speaking, than the man who has a tremendously facile mind, picks up things like that and doesn't have to work. He wasn't interested in results. He was interested in the student learning to apply himself and working hard. That counted more than anything else. If you remember the story of Hagon from 2 weeks ago, when he had this mystic vision, angels, Magidim, were willing to tell him the secrets of Torah, what did the Gaon do? He chased them away. Why? Because the Gaon did not want to know Torah in easy ways. Easy triumphs they looked down upon. And this was a triumph. An easy way to learn? No. He would have opposed sleep learning and having things drummed into you while you're in a somnolent. Nothing of the sort. To study meant to work. Without work, it isn't worth the entire effort. In addition to amal, or as a consequence of it, he stressed hasmoda, regularity, constancy of learning. He instituted, for reasons which will later become clear, the mishmar system, which meant, how would you say mishmar? Guards, or not guards. A watch. It meant that at every single moment of the day, there must be someone in the besmedrich studying. A watch in the sense of a guard, on duty. Someone had to be on duty learning Torah. Not for one moment out of 24, out of the whole year, should there be a moment that someone isn't studying Torah. And therefore, Reb Chaim took upon himself Shabbos, Erev, Friday nights, and the night of every Yontif, and Yom Kippur, he stayed up all night. Because he knew on those days, the men of the yeshiva would not want to be in the yeshiva, or they couldn't be. He took that duty for himself. He emphasized, finally, the dignity of the scholar. He was terribly upset by the condition of the yeshivas in his day. The first thing he did was to change terminology. No more, he said, shall a student of the yeshiva be referred to as a yeshiva bocher. From now on, it's a yeshiva man. And Lithuanians do that. They never say yeshiva bocher. They always say a yeshiva man. Yes, a 13-year-old is a yeshiva bocher. But when he's 16 and 17 and 18, he is a yeshiva man. The difference is between a schoolboy and a scholar. He was not interested in schoolboys and yeshivas. That's for cheder. When you come to the yeshiva, you have to have your dignity. He therefore cut out the system in Volozhin of esen teg. You know what esen teg is. The boy, the yeshiva bocha, was at the mercy of the townsfolk. Every few days he would be assigned to another balabos where he would, at the mercy of the balabosta, have food. And the quality, of course, varies according to the anecdote you've heard. But Reb Chaim cut this out. Instead, he managed to raise the funds and to give each student a regular stipend and let him eat where he wants at his own discretion and his own choosing. Nevertheless, he was afraid that the new status that he was giving the student might lead to haughtiness. And therefore, every Shabbos, he would preach only to the yeshivalite, to the yeshiva men, about the sin of arrogance and of intellectual snobism. He wanted them to have dignity, but not to be intellectual snobs. Under Reb Chaim, a revolution was created in Torah education, and Volozhin became what Bialik later called it, the Bet HaYotzer L'Nishmat HaUmah, the house, the pottery, the factory where the soul of our people was forged. Let's now go to, from educational to philosophy, to what we might call his theology, his attitude to the Hasidim. You recall from our talk 2 weeks ago that the teacher of Reb Chaim, the Gaon, was the zealous leader of the Mesnagdim, a bitter, unrelenting opponent of the Hasidim, the man who was out to destroy the movement. Reb Chaim was one of the few people who, together with his younger brother, Reb Zalmala, who died very young, unfortunately, never signed the ban, the cherem, the excommunication against the Hasidim. Interestingly, this presents a problem, a psychological problem. Reb Chaim has such tremendous reverence for the Gaon. He was overwhelmed. His knees literally quaked when he came to see him. How come he didn't follow his teacher? The answer is that he was a real student. He wasn't just a fawning outsider who wanted to be known as an insider of the Gaon's circle. He really was a student of the Gaon. The Gaon taught emes, truth, independence, even against authority. So Reb Chaim followed the truth as he saw it against the authority of the Gaon. If I'm a real student of the Gaon, then I must be enough of a student of the Gaon to reject the Gaon's ideas. And that is precisely what he did with the greatest Derech Eretz. Never chas v'shalom saying a word against the Gaon, never showing his displeasure openly, but never signing the ban against the Hasidim. In fact, he never used the typical word that Misnagdim use for the Hasidim. They call them in the entire literature the Kat. What does Kat mean? You recall the sect. In that way, they tried to show that Hasidism was an offshoot, out of the mainstream of Judaism. Reb Chaim never used the word sect. As a matter of fact, in his major work, apparently it hadn't been noticed until very recently, he uses a euphemism. Whenever he wants to refer to the Hasidim, he certainly doesn't call them Hasidim. That would be going too much to their side. Hasidim means the pious, and he didn't want to recognize them to that extent. He refers to them beautifully, and there are many shades of meaning to this. Ela hachafetzim bekirvat Elokim. Those who desire the closeness of God. The Hasidim always were intoxicated with God's imminence, his presence. So he referred to them as Ela hachafetzim bekirvat Elokim. On the one hand, it was a compliment, wasn't it? But if you remember your Haftorah from Yeshayahu on Yom Kippur, Yeshayahu uses this to describe hypocrites. So that the term, at one and the same time, was critical, but even while it was critical, it was complimentary. More than this, no one could demand of the student of the Gaon. As it is, it was a tremendous act of personality for him to be able to do this. But it was so well disguised that no one ever realized he meant them. But if you use this as a code, you can discover the whole Nefesh HaChaim, his whole attitude in his major work. As a matter of fact, I didn't even mention his major work. We hardly have anything from Reb Chaim. We have a few tshuvas, a few responsa, gathered together by a grandson called Chutam Meshulash. We have a very slim volume which contains his major ideas called the Nefesh HaChaim, published 3 years after his death. It went into 7 editions subsequently. In fact, it's such a very small volume that for years I've been told there's nothing to say about it. I spent at least 5 difficult years working on it, and recently when I returned to it, I've discovered that I could spend another 5 years on it. Very slim volume, but chock full of brimming, over-brimming, with ideas, theories, insights that really will take a lifetime to completely spell out in all their implications. Where are we? Yes. In the Nefesh HaChaim, where he has his major ideas, he refers to the Hasidim then with this code word, Hachafetzim Bekirvat Elokim. Reb Chaim rejected both extremes. He rejected the extreme Misnagdim, who were vitriolic, and sometimes so zealous in their persecution, it's incredible. Much of this literature of the Misnagdim against the Hasidim, as well as some of the reverse literature, ought to remain in libraries untouched and never published. He accepted Hasidic students in his yeshiva. If you remember that the Vilna Gaon preferred not to intermarry with Hasidic families, to read them out of the Jewish people, you can realize how far Reb Chaim went when he gladly invited them. And when passers-by came, Hasidim, he would invite them to his study and ask the Hasidim, what is the latest vort, the latest bon mot that you heard from the Chabad teachers, either of Shnei Zalman in his day, or later his son Reb Duba. And his own son, Reb Yitzchak Volozhiner, in his drashas, used to repeat many of the Hasidische Werte of the Chabad teachers. So he came very close to reconciling Misnagdism with Hasidism. It's interesting to see the development. In the days of his teacher, when Reb Chaim was an adult, absolute bitterness. From the Hasidic side, the moderate, the one who was closest to the Misnagdim, was the Lubavitcher movement, the Chabad movement. Here, the founder of Chabad, Reb Shneur Zalman, about whom we talked last year, if any of you may recall, was in his Tanya the first one to make a gesture towards the rabbinic Lithuanian world. And Reb Chaim, in his Nefesh HaChaim, it can be shown, was the first one to respond to this gesture. So that quietly, the dialogue was joined. The Hasidim through the Chabad, making the first overture to the Misnagdic world, Reb Chaim quietly, without exciting his zealous rightists in his camps, making the gesture back towards the world of Chabad and therefore the world of Hasidism. Both of them were looked upon with suspicion by the others. So the Misnagdim, who would have liked to have attacked Reb Chaim but couldn't, because he was the great Talmud of the Gaon, attacked the Chabad. And the extreme Hasidim instead attacked Reb Chaim. It reminds me of a story that my grandfather, Zecharo Levoch, used to tell me. I wonder if my mother will remember it. That when he was a little boy, I don't remember if he told me about himself or about someone else, he and a friend decided to play hooky, to play truant. And instead of going to cheder, they went into the field to play. When suddenly the two boys noticed that their fathers were coming towards them with their sleeves rolled up, about to administer some very effective psychology. And when they saw that, so my grandfather said to the other boy, "Quick, let's run." So the other boy said, "No, don't run." He said, "But they're going to beat us up." He said, "So we'll beat them up." So my grandfather said to the other youngster, "What are you talking about? The Megmishlogna Taten, how can you hit a father? You crazy?" He says, "Don't be silly. I'll beat up your father, you beat up my father." which is in effect what happened when the Reb Chaim and the Shneur Zalman began to come towards each other. Each side began to beat the other one, hoping to pull them apart, but unsuccessfully. Now let's get down to the gut issues. When you read the Nefesh HaChaim, you're taken aback. What were the two greatest issues in the Hasidic world that annoyed Reb Chaim? Because the Nefesh HaChaim, even though it's a gesture of reconciliation, is a critique against Hasidism. Not a bitter critique, an intellectual critique, a theological critique. But it's expressed in matters that to the untrained modern mind seem ludicrous. The two things that most bothered Reb Chaim are as follows. Number one, that the Hasidim davened late. That according to the din, you have to daven shacharis or lein shema up to a certain time of the morning. And the Hasidim took their time and went over the boundary. And mincha, you have to daven only until it's dark, but not after the sun comes down. Hasidim would stretch it. That was number one, that terribly exercised Reb Chaim. Second, there's a halacha that you always should think about Torah. But when you walk the mevoos hametunafim in dirty alleys where there is dirt open and exposed, you're not allowed to be mahara, not allowed to think of Divrei Torah. And the Hasidim were not overly careful. They were mahara Divrei Torah even in mevoos hametunafim. Imagine, I would give any money in the world to have all our Jews do that today. Let them be mahara b'Divrei Torah wherever they want, as long as they think of Torah. But Reb Chaim was very upset by this, because the Hasidim took a lax attitude towards meditation in places that were unclean, which was against Talmudic law. What bothered them? After all, doesn't it seem trivial to make a whole issue about two such problems? Actually, they're very important. Not because they themselves are so important, but because they encompass and express fundamentals where Reb Chaim was afraid that Hasidism is going over the line. Take the first one, late praying. The Baal Shem Tov himself never prayed late. He prayed at the crack of dawn. But his students or his student students, Reb Levi Yitzchak Barditcheva and Reb Michal of Zlotchev, they were the ones who instituted, according to Hasidic tradition, the idea of davening late. Later, it was particularly a Polish dynasty, the Pszyscha, who made a virtue of davening late to the displeasure of certain other great tzaddikim or Hasidic teachers, the Kuznetz and others. The Hasidim offered many fanciful reasons for this that are really of no concern of ours now. But what was the real reason for this late davening? The real reason was that prayer consists of two poles. One is kavana and one is keva. Keva means the fixed order of service. You have to say certain words in a certain posture at a certain time. It's the normative element, the halachically defined element of prayer. The Jew prays in a certain manner. But in addition to the words and the posture, the heart of tefillah is kavana, intention, to mean it, to have an inner participation, and to know that you're standing before HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and to express it. Now for the chassid, first of all, kavana was more than cognitive knowledge, more than knowing that I stand before God intellectually. It meant ecstasy. It meant dveikus. It meant pouring my heart out. It meant getting so involved emotionally that I could clap my hands in the middle of davening, or jump, or dance, or cry out in Yiddish and break into the middle of the Shemoneh Esrei with a sudden eruption, tatazisa in himmel. Which, if you daven with real Hasidim, not all real Hasidim, but certain kinds of Hasidic groups, it's a rather common occurrence. Why? Because the sense of rapture, the sense of fervency, the sense of kavana in its ecstatic dimension, its experiential dimension, breaks through the keva. Now, if it becomes important to have kavana, if kavana therefore is so important, well, a kavana can't be summoned up like this unless it's a post-hypnotic suggestion. If we're going to stop now on Davin Maariv, not everyone will suddenly be able to throw himself into kavana. Sometimes you've got to wait. Wait until the spirit moves you, quite literally. You can't just suddenly summon it up from within. A great tzaddik can do it. A highly developed saintliness of personality can manage such summoning up of kavana, in the sense of ecstasy. But the ordinary chassid can't. So the ordinary chassid will wait. If I find that it's now 9 o'clock in the morning and 9:30 is the Zman Kriyashma, and if I wait, if by 9:30 I'm not ready, so I'll wait till 10 o'clock. I'm not in a hurry. And if necessary, I'll say the Shema, and Daven Shachar is at 12 o'clock. As a result, the late davening became expressive of a worldview that the pneumatic, the personal, the ecstatic is more important than the normative, the legal, the halachic. The kavana was going to overwhelm and submerge the keva, not only in davening, not only in tefillah, but throughout all aspects of life. In the Nefesh HaChaim, Reb Chaim records, and he was a very sober personality, that he himself had visited Hasidic communities, he doesn't say Hasidic, certain communities in a certain district, where one Jew said to the other, "See if the stars are out, because if they're not out yet, we can't have a mincha." So far had the distortion of the Zman Tefillah become among certain Hasidic groups, that they didn't say it's all right to daven mincha after the Seisak HaChavim, but they insisted upon waiting for Seisak HaChavim before mincha. So that because of this fear that the experiential, the dveikus, will overwhelm the halachic and the mitzvah, it became necessary to reinforce the importance of zman, of a time limit, which became the symbol, therefore, of normative Judaism, of halacha. The critique of Reb Chaim is very simple. If, he says to the Hasidim, you are going to insist on kavana, so much so that you're willing to ignore the time element, then what happens if it's now Pesach and I don't have the proper kavana for matzah? Will you say that I can eat matzah in Shavuos if I have the right kavana, and blow shofar on Pesach, and have the lulav in Yom Kippur, and fast on Sukkot? It should be so. If I take a piece of matzah on Rosh Hashanah and I have tremendous kavanah and I jump out of ecstasy, I should be able to do it. What you've succeeded in doing is destroying the halacha. And what does this mean? Does this remind you of anything historically that bothered Reb Chaim and all sensitive misnagdim? What does it mean, destroying the halacha? It means becoming antinomian, against the law. Well, why were they so worried about Hasidim destroying the halacha? Anyone? Right, yes, who? Shapsitzvi destroyed the halacha. He came out in favor of a mystic quality which would break the reins and establish his freedom from the mold of the halacha. And therefore, the Reb Chaim and all the Misnagdim were very sensitive about anything that remotely smelled of the Sabbatian heresy and therefore this particular interest. How about the second problem? Hirhur b'mavoos hatmetanofim, meditation in unclean places. You recall that the Hasidim were great immanentists. We spoke 2 weeks ago and last year that in understanding the Rabbonu Shel Olam, there are two aspects. Divine transcendence, God as he is beyond the world, kadosh, 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 his kedusha, his beyondness, and God as he has kavod, as he has glory, which means what? He is immanent, he is within the world, that God is every place. The Hasidim emphasized divine immanence. God is every place. Their tremendous cry was, Meloch al ha'aretz kvodo, leis asar ponui minei, no place is free of God. They emphasize, therefore, that God is available in every aspect of life. And when you're tying your shoelace, the act of tying the shoelace should be able to send you into spells of religious ecstasy. Because in this, too, you can find a nitzos alakami mal, an aspect of God. If God is every place, then all of life becomes an opportunity for holiness. But more so, not only does all of life become an opportunity for the religious experience and for holiness, but what else? All of the world, all of the cosmos, is uniformly filled with the divine presence, and all of the world is uniformly holy. And therefore, the tendency on the part of the Hasidim to say that you can be Mahara Divrei Torah, even b'mavoos hametonofim, there is no such thing as dirt. There is no such thing as a lowly object. Every object exists because of God inhering in it. Therefore, there is nothing in the world that is contemptible, that is dirty, that is soiled, that is filthy, that is unclean. The greatest uncleanliness exists only because of God. Therefore, every place is godly. If every place is godly, I can be Mahara Divrei Torah every place. Not that they wanted to be Mahara Divrei Torah so much, but by asserting the din, or by asserting the violation of the law of Hirhur Divrei Torah, they emphasize the philosophic or theologic principle of immanence, that God is every place equally. Reb Chaim was terribly upset by this. Why? Again, he saw in this the destruction of halacha. Why? Why? Halacha is built upon the concept of pluralism. I don't mean pluralism in the cultural sense. We speak of American being culturally pluralistic. Value pluralism. The halacha recognizes distinctions in the world. For instance, the Mishnah says, Eser Kedushos Hain. There are 10 levels of holiness. The Har Habayis is holier than Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is holier than Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael is holier than Bavel. Bavel, perhaps, is holier than the rest of the world. So you have level upon level. This is Asa, this is Muta, this is Tomei, this is Tohor, this is Chayiv, this is Potter. This you must and this you must not. This means that in the world, you are constantly meeting up with differentiation. But if you're going to say that God is uniformly immanent, so that you can be Mahara B'Divrei Torah, meditate in Torah every place, what does it lead you to in the next step? To say, if I don't recognize the distinction between clean and dirty, then I also may not recognize the distinction between permitted and forbidden, between clean and unclean, and I'm back at the Sabbatian heresy of antinomianism. No more halacha. Everything is so holy that nothing is unclean. Everything is so holy that everything becomes permitted. This was the fear of Reb Chaim, that Hasidism would relapse into Sabbatianism. Of course, it never did. Does it mean, incidentally, that Reb Chaim denies that God is every place? Does it? Reb Chaim believes that God is every place. He believes that God is uniformly immanent. But here he comes to a remarkable twist that's terribly important for us, especially for young people who still are very much troubled by theological problems. Reb Chaim says, in thinking about God, you must make the following distinction. Mitzido, mitzidenu. We have to look at the world from a human point of view, and we cannot be that arrogant that we are going to presume to look at the world from God's point of view. From God's point of view, the world isn't real. From God's point of view, the world is an illusion. What do we count to God? God, the Ein Sof, the infinite, the creator of the cosmos and the whole cosmos, against which we are nothing but an atom of dust floating over the abyss. This whole cosmos is nothing in the eyes of God. Does it mean, therefore, that we don't count? From God's point of view. But we don't have the right to look at the world from God's point of view. God insisted, by revealing himself to us and giving us a Torah, that we look at the world from our point of view. From our point of view, there is a world which is structured, which has holy and unholy, sacred and profane, clean and unclean, kodosh, chol, higher kedusha, lesser kedusha. What Reb Chaim is doing, in other words, is saying that man, if he goes far enough in his philosophic contemplation, has no choice but to commit suicide. You ultimately come to the point where if you look at yourself from God's point of view, you're nothing. And then if you're nothing, you have defeated the will of God, because God wants you to believe you're something. He wants you to look upon the world as real. So you can no longer ask the question, is the world really real? No, from God's point of view, no. From my point of view, yes. And you can say that God's point of view is more real than my point of view, because I am me and I'm not God. Are you all confused? No, it's not a rationalization. It's not a rationalization. It means that it's a kind of theology that recognizes, to begin with, man's inherent intellectual and spiritual limitations. That it's not only morally an act of presumption to look at the world from God's point of view, but it's illogical. I cannot, in essence, look at the world through your eyes, because they're your eyes, not mine. Man, it's almost like a scientist considering in his theory the possibility of his own errors, which every decent scientist does. What he is saying is that I may have an idea of what the world is from his point of view, but I may not act on that. What he does, therefore, is he sets up a barrier between theology and halacha. Theologize, if you wish, but halacha is halacha. And this is his great principle. From God's point of view, maybe God is everywhere immanent. But God also wanted me to look at him from my point of view. The world is real. There may be no hero b'mavoas ha'tanofim. The halacha remains. No matter how pneumatic and ecstatic I get, no matter how theological I become, the ma'aseh mitzvah le'ikuva, halacha remains dominant and must never be affected by philosophizing, rationalizing, or theologizing. I say it's important for us for an obvious reason. Because with Time and Newsweek, theology has become the province of everybody. And it becomes very easy to become obsessed with an idea which the reporter never understood in the first place, and to be led astray. This is a very serious problem for young students, because young students generally think much more cogently and much more seriously than adults do, than they will when they're adults. And the problems are much more real. And therefore, the answer of Reb Chaim, expressed in these terms, has to be understood in a very profound way. Now, in all this, it's a critique of Hasidism, isn't it? And do you notice how high the level? It's the first time. Until now, the way you spoke to a Hasid was by calling him an apikores, a poshei Yisrael, an ochei Yisrael, a sonei Yisrael. Every word in the entire lexicon of vituperation was hurled at the Hasidim. They had their chashkalach too, mind you, who hurled it right back, but largely it was by the Misnagdim against the Hasidic world. Despite all this, Reb Chaim, in his critique, is moderate. His manner is urbane. Contrast that to the Gaon, his great Rebbe, whom he worshipped, a man who couldn't denounce the Hasidim often enough. You know, every time I think of denouncing often enough, I remember the story of Lahavdol Elef Alfei, Ribei Revovos Havdolos, the story of Stephen Wise, who had denounced from his pulpit a certain politician in New York. Immensely, like every Friday night, a Sunday, a Saturday, whenever it was, he would denounce him from the pulpit. Finally, at a cocktail party, someone introduced him to this politician. He said, "You should know him." He said, "Meet Mr. So-and-so, Rabbi Wise." So the man said, "Well, you should know me. You've denounced me often enough." He said, "Often, yes. Enough, not." Our last theme, and the greatest theme of Reb Chaim. the theme to which the last part of the Nefesh Chaim is devoted, the great climax of his life, his greatest contribution, and the part of the Nefesh Chaim where Rav Chaim, although an indifferent stylist usually, a typical rabbinic Hebrew which is not terribly poetic, suddenly waxes eloquent, and you see a new kind of personality emerging when he writes of the glory of Torah and the supernal heights to which the study of Torah can raise a man literally above his natural limitations. Of course, he begins with the great Mishnah and Peah, the Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam, the study of Torah above all else in Jewish life. This principle received its most radical formulation by Rav Chaim of Volozhin. For Rav Chaim, and here I'm faced with a problem. I've worked on this thing so much that it's difficult for me to put it into only a few sentences. It's difficult, in fact, to put it into many sentences. So please bear with me. For Rav Chaim, Torah is more than Torah. When you and I say Torah, what do we mean? We mean all of Judaism, we mean Tanakh and Talmud, we mean the Chumash. Take the Chumash. What do you mean by the Chumash? The revealed will of God. God said, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, Lo Yisitzach, V'yasu Tzitzis Al-Kanfei V'gdehem, various rules and various stories, Breishis Bara, and Ve'el Shmos, Vayikra. For Reb Chaim, Torah is much more than this. The Torah that you and I read is only the end product of a whole mystical development. Torah that we know, the Torah of commandments and narratives, is the outer shell. The inner Torah, the real Torah, doesn't have any words. It's a mystical being. In theology, we say this is the hypostasis of Torah. It's hypostasized Torah. Torah becomes not only a collection of laws or sentences, it becomes a being. A being, an independent being, an organic entity that has very high connotations. Not only that, but Rav Chaim maintains that Torah is really an aspect of God. Not only the will of God, not only the revelation of God. In a mystical way, it's identified with God. This is what the Torah says. Kutcher brichu Yisrael v'yoraisa chadhu. God, Israel, and Torah are one. Israel for Rav Chaim means the student of Torah. When you study Torah, what is Torah? Torah is God, kaviyachol. So when you study Torah, you unite with the Torah. If you unite with the Torah, what are you really doing? You're uniting with whom? With God. So if you reach the ultimate dveikus, the ultimate communion, not by going into an ecstasy, as the Hasidim said, but rather by the study of Torah. Intellectually rigorous, calculating, sometimes demanding of you business shrewdness in the study of Migo. And in all this, you are at one, literally at one, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. This Torah, this mystical Torah, therefore, existed before the world existed. When the Kabbalah speaks of God revealing himself, and the Nefesh HaChaim is built almost completely on Kabbalah, it's expressed in Kabbalistic terms, God revealed himself by creating, right? God was completely self-contained in his infinity and opened up, as it were, and emanated the world. The Torah, as a part of God, existed before the world. So that Torah is not revelation. Torah precedes revelation. If by revelation we mean the world coming into being and everything in the world, and Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and Geneva, and Zela, and Tzitzis, and Tefillin, and Shabbos, the real Torah, the essential Torah, pre-existed the creation of the world. Well, from this you have a tremendous amount of consequences. First of all, it means that Torah is the chief value of existence. Second, it means there's only one purpose to life, and that is to realize Torah. And third, it means, and Rav Chaim takes this with deadly seriousness, it means that the world cannot exist without Torah, because the world comes from God. And if Torah is in union with God, then without the Torah, there is no world. And that's why he set up a mishmar in Volozhin. That's why he refused to allow one moment to go on without Torah. And he says time and again, and this is the locus classicus, this is the great statement of Rav Chaim that becomes the great theme of Lithuanian Torah scholarship that has dominated two centuries, that if there were one moment without Torah in the world, it would be reduced to ashes all over again. for Reb Chaim, for the Hasidim, it was important to study Torah every day. For Reb Chaim, it was important to study Torah all day. Kol Hayom, not B'chol Yom. Take the relation of Torah to the mitzvahs, the problem of study and practice. It was debated from the days of Rab Kiva and Rab Tarfon down through the ages. Hasidim naturalized Torah. They saw it as part of the whole structure of mitzvahs. For Reb Chaim, Torah was the source of mitzvahs. Without Torah, there are no mitzvahs. The only reason a mitzvah is important is because it comes from the Torah. Take tefillin. Tefillin are holy, aren't they? But they are holy, they are sanctified, says Reb Chaim, only because of the words Ukshartem la'os ayodecha that appear in the Torah. Which means that the mitzvahs have no longer their own autonomy, their own significance. Their significance is derivative from the Torah. The mitzvahs are branches of the Torah. For Hasidim, prayer was more important than Torah. In fact, Torah became a kind of prayer. For Reb Chaim and the Misnagdim, prayer became a kind of Torah. Did I have it right? No. For the Hasidim, the study of Torah was a kind of prayer. It had as an effect bringing God down. For Reb Chaim, prayer required intellection. It required study. So much so was he an intellectualist, a Torah man in all his conceptions. An example. The Mishnah tells us that on three things the world stands. Torah, Avodah, Gemilas Chasadim. Torah means the study of Torah. Avodah means prayer. Gemilas Chasadim is charity and kindness. Doesn't this disprove Reb Chaim? Doesn't this prove the Hasidim are right, that Torah is only one of many values? Reb Chaim accepts the challenge. He says, and this is an astounding interpretation, he says that this Mishnah applies only to the pre-Sinaitic days, before Matan Torah. After Matan Torah, there's only Torah. There's no Avodah and Gemilas Chasadim. There is Avodah and Gemilas Chasadim, but they're dependent, contingent upon Torah. Why? Very simple. He says, before Matan Torah, were you allowed to worship any place you wanted? Could you offer a sacrifice on West End Avenue? Yes, the Bomos. The fathers, the forefathers, the Ovos offered sacrifices every place. After Torah was given, can you offer a sacrifice any place? Avod any place? No. Why? Only what the Torah tells you. And that's in the Mishkan or the Mikdash. So the Torah, after the giving of the Torah, Avodah was circumscribed by Torah. Gemilas Chasadim. The Taz, one of the great commentaries, says that to lend your money on interest, on ribis, is an act of Gemilas Chesed. It's an act of Gemilas Chesed. When? Before Matan Torah. Any businessman looking for money to invest knows that to get money from somebody with interest is an act of Gemilas Chesed. It's an act of charity. It's not charity, it's a favor. Call it what you will, he's ready to accept it. And he'll praise you for it. Yet, we do not allow interest on personal loans. The rabbis are extremely severe about malvei ribis, usurers. They say they'll never stand up for Tchiyas HaMeisim. Why not? If it's a Gemilas Chesed? The answer is, he says, before Matan Torah, Gemilas Chesed, yes. After Matan Torah, only Torah. The Torah says, no ribis, let it be a Gemilas Chesed. It doesn't count. So there's only one foundation for Judaism. That foundation is Torah. Everything else derives from Torah, and therefore the study of Torah becomes the great theme of all Judaism. Well, I have much more to say, but I'm going to skip it. Just briefly, we have the problem of motivation. Why should a person study? There are many motivations for study. Money, position, status, ecstasy, religious experience, all for the sake of Torah itself. Reb Chaim took the last one. Study must be for the sake of study, not, as the Hasidim said, for existential reasons, not for experiential reasons, not for reasons of rapture, not for reasons of love of God, only for reasons of the Torah itself. Let me just read you one brief passage from the Nefesh HaChayim. Scripture has said, says Reb Chaim Volozhiner, Torah is a tree of life to those who take hold of it. Eitz Chaim Hi L'Machazikim Bo. Let man therefore establish in his heart to know in his mind that if he were drowning in a mighty river and saw before him a strong tree, certainly he would make every effort to take hold of and cling to it with all his strength, not letting it go even for a moment. Since his life hangs only on this, who would be so foolish as not to understand that if he were lazy even for a moment and loosened his hold, he would drown immediately? So is the Holy Torah called Eitz Chaim, the tree of life. For only during the time that a man is seized with the love of Torah and engages and meditates in it regularly, only then does he live a true higher life and is bound up and attached, as it were, to the Chei HaOlamim, the life of the worlds. Blessed be his name. For the Holy One, blessed be he, and his Torah are one. And if heaven forbid he rejects his study and abandons his regular pursuit in order to engage in the follies and pleasures of the world, he is removed and cut off from the higher life and drowns in the raging evil water. To conclude then, what did Reb Chaim give to the world and to posterity? He founded the mother of all yeshivas of the last century and this century. And as such, he is the founding father of the yeshiva movement. As an educator, he not only built and administered great schools, but he created a revolution in the philosophy of Jewish education. A Lithuanian misnagid, disciple of the Gaon, he yet rose to great heights in responding to the conciliatory gestures of Hasidism and ushered in a new Irenic and peaceful era. A brilliant thinker, a philosopher of the halacha, who used Hasidism as a foil to propose broad and profound expositions of classical halachic and rabbinic Judaism. Above all, he gave the greatest expression to the value of Torah and its cosmic dimensions. He left behind him a family that was active in Jewish history and renown. His son, Reb Yitzchak, became his successor in Volozhin. Next week, please God, we will speak briefly about the rest of his family, his descendants, the Netziv, the Beleza, and especially the man whom we will devote our lecture, not next week, in 2 weeks, the Chaim Briska, and this great revolution in halachic thinking. The Soloveitchiks today are part of the family that is a great family of Jewish aristocracy, known in our literature as the Beis Harav. And that is why the head of the family is always called the Rav, as was Reb Chaim Volozhiner himself, the Rav or the Rav. On his deathbed in 1821, at the age of 72, he left only two requests of his son. One, that he not abandon the yeshiva, but he continue to build it. And two, that he publish the slim volume, The Nefesh HaChaim. In these requests, we find the perfect blending of both facets of this tremendous individual, the practical and the theoretical, the combination of the Ish HaMaaseh and the Ish HaMachshava. He was a man who represented
the best of both worlds.